What are the dangers for your children of those medical clinics in retail shops?
Black-white differences in breast cancer outcomes.
If mom smokes, does it have an impact on the child's behavior?
And rabies transmitted from an organ transplant.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 26th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I'm going to take us to the Journal of the American Medical Association first, looking at rabies that's transmitted in an organ transplant. I have to give you some little background on this. The reason I'm serving that up is because I think rabies is just such a horrible way to die and had a very powerful impact on me looking at people who died from it in Mexico City, lo these many years ago. So this, I'm totally horrified by this.
This is only the third known reported case of rabies transmitted from organ transplant. This was a person who had received a kidney and 18 months afterwards manifest rabies. Several things that are unusual about this. The long time it took to manifest the disease. In the other two cases, the recipient manifests the disease usually within 3 to 4 weeks. And obviously it was unsuspected in the donor. And it wasn't until they figured it out in the recipient, which by the way was several weeks later, just before the recipient died, that they go back and look at the tissue for the donor and discover that the donor had in fact had rabies acquired from handling raccoons. On the one hand, it's important for physicians and healthcare providers taking care of recipients to be aware that there is an occasional organ-related transmissible infection. But I want our listeners to understand that is incredibly rare. Between the years of 2008 and 2011, there were almost 114,000 patients that received a solid organ transplant. Among those 114,000 recipients, only 139, 0.1%, developed any type of donor-related disease. And that resulted in 29 deaths. During that same time, there were almost 27,000 individuals that died waiting for an organ transplant.
For me, what this illustrates is that there is an infection danger from transplantation, and also something that we've talked about a little bit too. One of our colleagues here at Johns Hopkins talks about blood transfusions and that those are tantamount to a transplant. And we know that in those, there are several infectious agents that are transmissible, and there are certainly things that are unknown that may be part of these transplants that subsequently end up producing a problem.
One of the differences between blood transfusions and solid organ transplants, and by the way, in both those circumstances, they're screened for routine infectious agents. When one actually donates blood, that blood could be kept for several days or weeks and tested for a number of different things before it's ever transfused. With a solid organ transplant, the decision is made very quickly, within the matter of hours or days. All the tests are done and the decision has to be made very quickly. And so to have something like this, rabies from a raccoon, which is a very rare occurrence to begin with, to not have that detected is not unimaginable.
I would sum this, I guess, by saying that as we become increasingly sophisticated in testing for these things, no doubt the panel of agents that are tested for is going to increase, and especially as we identify new agents. Let's turn then to another paper in this week's JAMA. That's the persistent observation that there are differences in survival with regard to many diseases, but in this case, it's in breast cancer in blacks versus whites.
This stems from the observation that if you look at the 5-year survival from breast cancer and compare blacks versus whites, there's about a 13% difference. So Elizabeth, I'm going to throw that back in your court. If I gave you that information, what would you surmise or think would be the cause of that?
Well, I think that often blacks are reluctant to come forward, don't get as much medical care, maybe from lower socioeconomic groups, may not be as educated. So I think there's a constellation of factors that could surround this disparity. But I also think from other studies we've discussed that there could also be a genetic underpinning to this, as we've seen in prostate cancer.
And in fact, that's what this study tried to address, some of the uncertainties that you mentioned. So they looked at almost 7,500 black women who had breast cancer over the age of 65, and they matched them to 7,500 white patients. And what they discovered was the difference in survival that were associated with treatment accounted for less than 1% of the difference. Most of the difference has little to do with their differences in treatment and much more to do with their demographics and how late they present in terms of their disease.
I don't think this paper addresses at all, though, this idea that biologically it may be a different disease in black women as compared to white women.
You're right, and that's kind of rolled up into demographics and into the presentation as well. So genetic components, demographic components, presentation components, cultural components, those seem to be much more important than the differences in the treatment that's rendered.
So the take-home message then for those black women who may be listening to this, or for those who provide care to them, is, hey, we do need to screen you. You need to come forward so that we can detect this early and hopefully improve your chances of survival. Let's turn now to JAMA Psychiatry, a study that's a little bit challenging, one that I served up as, hey, if mom smokes, what impact does this have on the child's behavior?
This is a study that is interesting more in its design than in the actual results. What this particular study did was it looked at three independent, what are called genetically sensitive research designs. They did a longitudinal cohort study that included biological and adopted children. Then they had another cohort, children that were adopted at conception with genetically related families and genetically unrelated families. They did everything they could to take care of all these other covariates. And what they discovered was that the offspring conduct problems was in fact related to maternal smoking across all three studies. There was a significant association between maternal smoking during pregnancy and offspring conduct problems.
We know, of course, that maternal smoking, bad idea. Smoking at all, bad idea. I guess we can interpret this as yet one more reason why women shouldn't smoke.
Yeah, this is clearly a risk factor. I won't say it puts the nail in the coffin. That's probably a pretty apt description for smokers anyway. I think it's more compelling data.
Let's turn then, since we're talking about children, to JAMA Pediatrics. Concerns that are being raised about whether getting care at a retail clinic, such as in Target or Walmart or any of the multitude of pharmacies that have a little freestanding retail clinic for very basic medical care for the most part, what happens if you get your kids treated in those places?
This is a fairly new phenomenon. These retail clinics are what people call RCs, but it's predicted by the end of this year there's going to be 6,000 of these nationwide. And as you mentioned, they're oftentimes located inside pharmacies. They're also in malls as well. What this study attempted to do was to address the parents' opinion of these parents who had actually attended one, and also to find out how the children were treated. So they actually went to pediatricians' offices, 19 different pediatricians, and they surveyed the parents there. And the first thing they asked was, have you ever taken your kid to one of these RCs? About a fourth of the parents had. In fact, the parents admitted that oftentimes they went to the retail clinics to receive care. If the parents went, they were more likely to take their children. When they asked them why they took their children, it's because they thought that it was more convenient. It didn't require office hours. And oftentimes they didn't want to bother the pediatrician, especially with what they considered relatively minor issues. In fact, most of what they sought care for was upper respiratory tract infections, sore throats, and colds. Here was the interesting thing, is about three-fourths of the kids walked out with antibiotics. About a third of the children that had a negative screen still walked out with antibiotics. We've talked before about the unnecessary administration of antibiotics in children that don't need them.
I guess there's another aspect to this study too. That's the idea that these kinds of visits are not subsequently reported to the child's pediatrician so that there's not a complete history.
Right. And in fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics discourages the use of these retail clinics because it disrupts continuity of care. And then oftentimes these are not staffed by physicians. They're oftentimes staffed by healthcare associates. There's no oversight of the treatment. They did ask the parents, did you tell your pediatrician about this? And only 42% said they even mentioned it to their pediatrician.
My favorite terminology for these places, of course, is docs in a box. I have to admit that when one of my daughters was younger and she needed a routine physical before participating in a sport, and it was August and all the parents were thinking about doing that, another parent gave me that tip. And because she has a very benign medical history, I thought, I'm taking her to this clinic and getting it done right away. So I understand why parents would make those kinds of selections, but I also think the caveats are pretty apt.
What this means is, as healthcare providers, we actually need to be able to understand that families want healthcare that's convenient, they want high quality care, they want a low cost, and they need to balance that need for the need to be seen with continuity. So we need to be better about meeting the needs of our patients.
Well, with that conclusion, I'm going to reveal that this is the study that I'm going to do this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.